So there's a story about the Buddha when he was a little boy. Of course, he wasn't the Buddha yet. He was just a kid, a little prince, Gotama, right? Wasn't that like his first name? Gotama. And the story is told in the Majjhima. Oops. One of those. Nikaya. One of the Pali Canon collections. And in this story, he went with his dad, the great, he wasn't a king, but he was like some kind of a lord. He took his son out with him when they were harvesting the field. And the little boy was out there, and, you know, the grown-ups were all busy harvesting the field, and so he kind of wandered off, and he was just watching what was happening. And he saw where the plow had passed, and he looked down, and he saw that there were all these little, like worms and all these little insects that had been killed and that were dying and struggling because the plow had, it was like plowing for grain, and the plow had cut through the earth, which is what happens when plows are going through the earth. And so there were all these little struggling beings. And first he just felt horrified, like it was his family. He felt just this upwelling of sadness and despair to see his family dying and struggling. But then it's also, according to the story, at the same moment, he also just realized he was just sitting on the earth, and it felt so beautiful to just be sitting on the earth. And he felt the sun, he felt the wind, and he just had this arising of a feeling of great contentment and joy at the same time. So, fast forward. Gotama is now, I guess he was in his early 20s after he left home, and he was out trying to become enlightened, and he was studying with all the great masters of the time. And there, and he was doing really, really hard practice. They were like, no pleasure, no fun, don't eat food, just work really hard, and you know, then you'll get enlightened. Lots of austerities, distrusting pleasure. And as we know, at some point, even though he excelled in these practices, he was very good at it. He was a good, very, very good student. He just felt like, surely there must be some other way to achieve enlightenment. And they say that when that thought arose for him of, surely there must be some other way, I mean, here I am, I'm skinny, I'm starving, I'm miserable, he remembered that time when he was a boy, and he remembered how he had sat under the rose apple tree on his father's land, and he remembered the coolness of the breeze and how that feeling of kind of just spontaneous, both compassion for all beings and also contentment and peace and the coolness of nirvana, actually. And he remembered that as a little boy, he had felt that. And that was like, oh, I think I'm going to try that again. Because if as a little child who hadn't done any kind of heavy-duty practices or anything, I had felt the coolness of nirvana, perhaps it's something natural to the human condition. Maybe we don't have to punish ourselves so much to feel the coolness of just this oneness with all beings. And that was what inspired him to go and sit down and engage in the self-reflection and deep study that led to his enlightenment and that led to his formulating these teachings that we call Buddhism. So I would say that my... one more thing from this story. They say, it says in this Mahima Nikaya sutra or writing that he said, I am not afraid of such pleasure. I am not afraid of such pleasure. You know, there had been this fear of pleasure when he was doing the austerities, that they were trying to force oneself into the sacred world. So the birth of the middle way was this man, this person, our root original teacher, who instead of trying to keep crushing his humanness, he sat down on the earth and said, I'm not afraid of such pleasure. And he sat and breathed and entered into his journey. And this was the birth of the middle way, which is our practice that we practice here in Buddhism. So I think that the ability to deeply feel, the ability to deeply feel our emotions is at the core of the Buddha's teaching. And that's what I want to talk about. Because this is something that I've been studying a lot in my recent, for the last 6 months or so. I've really been looking at this whole thing about what does Buddhism teach about emotion? You know, we have wonderful teachings about the mind, fantastic teachings about the mind, books and books and books and systems and lists and studies, and they're great and they're very liberative. But what about our emotions? What are we supposed to do about that, with that? And it's actually kind of, I find that as I've rooted around in the Buddhist teachings, it's rather, there's some rather conflicting opinions about emotions and how to practice with emotions, or whether one should even have emotions. So this is, right now I'm going to do a very short and probably extremely superficially incomplete little summary, but maybe it might stimulate you to look into this, or maybe some of you know more than I do about some of these areas. But it seems to me that in the Theravadan teachings, a lot of the early formulations of Buddhism, it's not so much, they don't really talk about emotion, it's more just feeling, the way that it is in, say, the Satipatthana, feeling it's pleasant, unpleasant, or neutral. And that's what's meant by feeling. And mindfulness of feeling means awareness of, is this pleasant, unpleasant, or neutral. But they don't really talk about anger, love, passion, jealousy, disappointment, you know, all those things that we call feelings. They don't really talk about that so much. And in fact, contemporary people who write in that tradition seem, and this might be my limited view, but it might seem that those things are considered more distractions to having a calm mind, and so we're somehow supposed to not have those feelings. We're just supposed to let go and just concentrate, just sit, just meditate. Now, the Vajrayana tradition, on the other hand, has a lot about emotion. I mean, this would be, you know, the Dalai Lama writes about love, writes about compassion. Pema Chodron, who's in, you know, comes from the Trungpa lineage, she, you know, she has books and books about, you know, totally dealing about with emotions. Reggie Ray, who also comes from the Trungpa lineage. Robert Preece, another teacher there. I'm sure many of the teachers that Kokyo and Shoho have been working with, they have quite a lot that they talk about emotion. Emotion as energy. So I have found that material to be quite helpful, but it's kind of funny, again, because the ways that Buddhist groups like to argue about who has the true Dharma, I think, Lori, you sent me some about a month ago. Lori's my purveyor of daily Buddhist things. Every morning when I open my computer, oh, there's my Buddhist thing from Lori. And so there was one of them that was Pema Chodron, and it was one of her most recent teachings, and she was talking about really going into your emotions and becoming friends with your difficult emotions. And what was equally interesting to me when I read it, along with her teaching, was this whole commentary afterwards, I guess it was online on Tricycle, of this Theravadan teacher just ripping her teaching apart and saying, oh, how self-indulgent. You know, that's not what the Buddha taught. The Buddha didn't talk about studying your feelings. That's so, you know, Western, and you know, he was like really, really huffy about it. And then there were all the people who had opinions about what he said. So, you know, Buddhists, we've been arguing about this stuff for a long time. And then the Vipassana tradition, I mean, that's the tradition that's given all the mindfulness stuff. So even though they're kind of Theravadan in origin, the way that it's evolving in this country is certainly, you know, the mindful way of depression, you know, is a whole book, or some of the books where you totally study your emotions. So it's kind of hard if you're trying to get some guidance. You're like, you know, what am I supposed to do? And then there's Zen. So on the one hand, it would seem, if you go reading our sutras and our ancestor stories, that they don't talk about any of that stuff. However, I have a belief that the ancestors, the Zen ancestors, they didn't talk about emotions, but they sure as heck show them. Those guys are crying all the time. If you read these stories, even Gene told me Subhuti, when he first heard the Diamond Sutra, he's not even Zen. What was his response when he heard the Diamond Sutra? He cried. Dogen, you read Dogen, I soaked my collar with my tears. You know, the Enlightenment story of Seppo, one of my favorites. He's not in our direct lineage, but he's a very close cousin. He was the one that he had a really, really hard time with practice, and he just felt like he was a real failure. And one time he was out wandering around with his Dharma brother, who was teasing him about how he just kept trying so hard to get enlightened. And finally, his friend said to him, you know, kind of in a big burst of feeling, you know, haven't you heard that what enters through the gate is not the family treasure? Let it flow forth from your breast, covering heaven and earth. So he was saying, stop trying so hard. Don't think you're going to get enlightened by sitting zazen all night. Show me who you are, you know? Let the treasure just flow forth from your heart. And then that was his enlightenment. He rejoiced and he went, oh, today I have finally attained the way. I have finally attained the way. So to me, when I read those, and there's more, you know, what is the intimacy? What is the secret under the robe? Intimacy. And then what does the student do when he hears that? You know, we cry. We cry in here all the time. I don't know about you. I'm not going to ask you to raise your hand whether or not you've ever cried in the Zendo, or in Dokusan, or when you're reading some of the material, or when you just get stopped in your day and you just go, oh God, you just get something about the Dharma and it makes you cry, right? That's emotion. So, I felt like, okay, I think I have permission from the ancestors to try to understand a little bit more about how to practice with emotion. And I've learned a few things that I'd like to share. And I'll say that a lot of this comes from studying some of the Vajrayana teachers, Robert Preece and Reggie Ray particularly, and also some from Rick Hansen and his wonderful book called Buddha's Brain, which I just think is a fantastic book. Rob Preece's book, Feeling Wisdom, and Reggie Ray's book, Touching Enlightenment, along with some other kind of more neuroscience-type medical things. But it's interesting that the emotion that that we are encouraged to feel, there's a difference between allowing and feeling and indulging and spinning. And I think maybe that's the point that the critics, like that Theravadan teacher who was being critical of, you know, wallowing in emotion and challenging that as an authentic, you know, Buddhist activity. I think that there is a good point there, because it is true that wallowing in our feelings, in our emotions, is a big source of suffering, just the way that obsessive thinking is a source of suffering. I think they're the same thing. I think any kind of obsession where we're separating ourselves from our actual experience, our actual body experience, and where we're, you know, going away somewhere into a story, whether it's a story of the head or a story of the heart, I think that is part of what we are challenged to recognize as a delusory activity, as delusion, because it's not actually what's happening right now. We go somewhere with it, and we make something with it, and we turn it into something else. That's the part that's the problem. As Robert Priest says, and forgive me for if you're newer to Zen and you don't know about the 12-fold chain, I'm going to make a reference here to that, he says the problem is not the seventh link. It's not that we make contact, or that our sense objects make contact with the world. He says the problem is the eighth. It's the grasping. That's the point of the problem. It's not a problem that we respond to the world, say, with anger. Because anger can be an extremely important way that, for example, we recognize a boundary, or we recognize something that we need to do to keep ourselves safe or to keep somebody else safe. It can be a very important kind of a signal. It's like a signal, okay? So the fact of it isn't a problem, but what do we do with it? We spin it, we chew it, we indulge it, we use it to feed a story. We use it to do mean things to other people. So the practice, say, with the anger would be neither, and this is actually not a I don't know, is Gabor Mate a Buddhist teacher? I don't know. He's a doctor who writes, he wrote one book called In the Realm of the Hungry Ghosts about addiction. So maybe he's a Buddhist if he called his book about addiction that. And he also, my favorite book of his is called When the Body Says No. And he talks about, and see, this is the danger of trying to say, anger? I don't have anger. I'm a Buddhist. Buddhists aren't supposed to be angry. Therefore, if I feel anger, what I need to do is pretend it doesn't exist. Stuff it. He actually claims that suppressed anger is a source of disease and profound suffering in our lives. And in working with people for decades who have lots of you know, autoimmune diseases or inflammatory-based diseases or cancers. This isn't to say we create these things, but we augment and we emphasize and we add to our difficulties when we think that we're supposed to suppress. But neither are we supposed to, what's the term that he uses, act out in an unregulated way. So his point, he thinks, and I think to me this is Dharma, even though he's talking as a doctor. He says, you know, both repression and unregulated acting out are avoiding the actual experience, which is just a physiological experience. That actually, if you can just feel it, what does it do? It transforms. And it dissipates. When it's like a storm, you know, when the storm is building and you feel the mugginess and you feel the tension in the air and all the animals and it's just this, and then it rains. And then it's like, you know, the cloud got released, the energy got released. But we get confused about this. We think releasing energy means, you know, being violent to people or being aggressive with people. And this invitation here is, it's just energy. Just allow it, experience it, and let it pass. Let it go. That's letting go. Letting go isn't, feeling bad, wrong, I don't have it, I'm letting it go. Letting go is fully inhabiting, feeling, allowing, and okay. Same with fear. Really important feeling alerts us to danger. Sadness makes us human. This is a sad world. There's a lot of sadness in being human. You know, to feel sad about what we experience, it's human. It's not bad. But somehow many of us have this like dichotomy as Buddhists where we think we're just supposed to be om calm all the time. And I think maybe, you know, that does come, but it comes by being human and allowing our human nature to express itself. I want to put in one more practice piece and then open it up for some discussion. And this is something that I've also found to be really, really helpful. Now, you know, Buddha, when he was formulating his teachings, one of the teachings that he came up with pretty early on was the immeasurables, the Brahma-viharas. They say he actually took the traditional dhyana states, which were practiced by the other holy people at the time, and the Brahma-viharas arose out of that. And the Brahma-viharas are the wholesome states of mind and heart to cultivate. Loving-kindness, metta, compassion, karuna, what the little baby boy Buddha felt for the worms, the spontaneous arising of compassion, karuna, mudita, which is taking joy in the happiness of others, feeling good when good things happen to other people, and is it upekka? Upeksha? Okay, upeksha, thank you, which would be equanimity. And that is the ability to maintain your stability whatever is going on around you. Mountain mind. I call that mountain mind. So fostering these wholesome states, to me, is very similar to this teaching of allowing ourselves to be emotional beings, because to me, loving kindness, compassion, experiencing joy, the joy of others, and equanimity are extremely emotional activities. Our heart and our mind working together is what allows us to arouse those feelings. You know, when you're, okay, I had an experience this week, not this last Monday, but the Monday before, I was working, and I had a really, really, really hard experience. I brought all the skills. I've done a lot of group facilitation over the years, and I brought all the skills that I've brought to countless groups over the years that always help people feel like, you know, they can be collaborative and get things done together. But this group had this one person who just refused to do anything positive. It's like she was completely committed to actively sabotaging all the thinking and all the work that the people in the group were doing. And every time she did it, this feeling of despair just started to really, you know, it just got to be just so hard. And there was nothing I could do. I felt helpless. It was so hard. I wanted to do something, but everything I tried didn't work for her. It didn't help her. It didn't help her open her heart. She just was really, really committed to my way or the highway, and I don't care what you all think. This is, you know, I'm not going to change. So I left that day just feeling, I felt mad at her, I felt mad at myself, I felt disappointment, I felt, you know, judgmental of the the superintendent that he hadn't warned me about her. I mean, you know, I was really reactivated, and it was really, really hard. And it took me about 4 days to really kind of settle down. I mean, I confess, I'm really embarrassed to say that, because, you know, that was 4 days. I was running, you know, my adrenaline was flowing, my brain was firing with negative thinking, and none of my practice, you know, wasn't helping me at all. I don't even think I showed up here. I think I just stayed home. But then, this is the thing with practice. At some point, you just gotta go, okay. Oh, I know what it was. I was starting the group on Sunday evenings this is the material that we're working with, by the way, if you're curious what we're doing over there from 5 to 6:20 on Sundays. This is the subject matter that I'm offering and encouraging people to practice with. So I think I confess that this is what happened. I thought, God, if I'm going to go and, you know, teach that group and do my first Sunday group, I better practice some of this stuff, or I'm a total hypocrite. That's what it takes sometimes. You know, that's what it takes sometimes. Something outside yourself, you know, something like a vow. My vow to the people who are going to show up on Sunday, you know. So I did, and let me tell you what I did. And this is a practice that I cannot recommend highly enough. It's a simple practice, and it's a practice that nourishes and activates the coherence of our heart, which actually physiologically affects our mind and our body. It affects our whole system. The heart is actually the strongest biological oscillator in our entire physical system. It has the power to influence and to change all the other systems in the body. You know, people used to think that the brain ran everything, but in the last 40 years or so, they've been doing a lot of studies, and they're actually finding that the heart has its own intelligence, and it actually informs the brain. It's not just the brain informing the heart. In fact, they work together, but they have different functions. You know, the brain, it has a different functions. It's ordering, analyzing, kind of, you know, compartmentalizing. But the heart, the part of the brain that the heart stimulates is equanimity. It's the Brahmaviharas. It actually is the Brahmaviharas. Compassion, equanimity, a broad view, the ability to see things from multiple perspectives. Those are the parts of the brain that get stimulated when the heart is coherent. So the way to bring the heart to coherence is to breathe slowly and deeply into the heart. You know how sometimes we say breathe through your mudra, which is a way to actually breathe down here in the hara, which is another energy center in the Buddhist and many other traditions. This is actually, you know, just do it right now. Pretend that you're actually breathing. No, don't pretend. Do it. Just breathing through your heart. And you can put your hand on your heart if that is helpful. That's something that some of the other teachers say about just really breathing. And when you do this and long enough that you really start feeling yourself calming down, your heart, the pattern of your heart and the way it influences your body actually changes. I have this thing that I got from these people who do this thing called heart math, where it's a little thing that you put on your ear, and then you plug it into your computer, and you have a program that you can buy. And it shows you visually the heart rate variability. And this isn't just like the heart, the pulse. This is actually the overall coherence, they call it, of the variability of the heart rate. So you can see, like you sit down and first you're kind of, you know, you're just coming out of your day and you're sort of agitated and it goes, you know, like that. And then as you sit and you breathe deep, the deeper, the slower, and the more from this area you breathe, you literally, in about maybe 5, maybe 10 minutes, you start seeing it starts getting more coherent. And they even have a sound. So when it's really off, it's quiet. And when it starts getting closer, you get one sound, and it gets blue. And then when you're really coherent, it's another sound, green. So you can even close your eyes and just do it. But what it does is it actually teaches your body, oh, this is the way to breathe to get my heart in coherence. And the second thing that gets the heart in coherence is actively arousing appreciation, love, and love. It's shocking to actually see, you know, and you know, you're sitting there and you're doing this and then you start, okay, now I'm going to try this other, okay, I'll start. Okay, who do I love? What do I love? Oh, Kathy, I love you. I love you. You're such a good person, really. Good girl. You're good. Boom, goes into green, you know? And then you experiment with it. You start thinking a nasty thought. Gets quiet. Red. You go, oh, my God, this is amazing, you know? So that's heart math. That's another practice that we can do. So the Brahmaviharas, sitting, calming, activating, arousing the Brahmaviharas nourishes our body, it nourishes our mind, and it nourishes our relationships with others. And I think that it, for some of us, it actually allows us to settle down and to sit and to have the experience of sitting be this cool breeze, you know, peaceful place that Buddha experienced as a little boy and then wanted to experience again. And spent his whole life encouraging us all to try to share in that practice with him. So now it's time, if you want to say something or ask something, love to hear that. Yeah.
I'm realizing that in the context of heart math, and use the word coherence, that I'm not sure I know what that means, coherence. So, I mean, in other situations, I know what coherence means, but I'm wondering, what are your thoughts about what does that actually mean, together, coherence, sticking? I mean, I was trying to get to the bottom.
You know, I don't know. It's the term they use, and as contrasted with, you know, just having a regular pulse. It's a term that they came up with, that it's more an overall pattern of order.
An orderly pattern.
Yeah. And when you see the coherence, it's like sometimes it looks like this, and sometimes it looks like this. But when it's not coherent, it goes like, you know. And whereas when it's coherent, you can see it. Literally. So that's what they call that coherence.
So within whatever parameters of the moment, whether wide or narrow, it stays within them.
Yeah, stable. It's like
consistent and stable.
Yeah, consistent and stable. Exactly.
Kathy, have you been practicing this in your everyday life, and so and how?
Well, that's the homework that we gave ourselves on Sunday night, was to try to do this. And so I have been practicing it more. Actually, I realized that in my car was probably the best place to practice, because usually what I do in my car is I punch on the radio and I listen to NPR. And sometimes I go over to KGO, and then I have to listen to the ads, and it's kind of a bummer. But there's a couple of the people on KGO that I think are interesting. So I'm usually punching back and forth between KGO and NPR. And I realize often when I do that, it's like, oh, God, I'm filling my brain with so much crap. I mean, yes, it's important to be informed about the news, but do I have to hear it 20 times in a day, the same story? I can, you know, go online, I can read the news, 20 minutes, educate myself, or listen to half an hour of NPR. Okay, I know the news now, thank you very much. What else do I want to do with this one precious life? What else do I want to do with my mind and my heart? And so I thought, oh, how about practicing heart coherence? How about when I'm driving? Because very often, I mean, I do longer drives, but a lot of times I'm, you know, I'm driving to the Zendo, or I'm driving to somebody's house, or, you know, I'm driving maybe a 10 or a 15-minute drive. Perfect time. Perfect time. So that's actually one that I've been finding is really helpful.
So how do you do it when you drive?
Breathe through my heart and think. Arouse thoughts of appreciation and gratitude, and if I need to say them out loud, say them out loud. I mean, maybe, you know, obviously if there's a source of agitation, then it can be really helpful to actually take that source of agitation and speak directly to that. But it could also just be in general, you know, who do I want to wish well to today? Or what message do I need to give myself to calm down? This is a quote from HeartMath about appreciation. When the mind is unmanaged, it focuses on what's not right. This is something that our minds do. And again, biologically, the amygdala is wired to scan for danger. And so that's what it does. So when the mind is unmanaged, it focuses on what's not right. This kind of victimized thinking. Oh, poor me, poor me, poor me, that mean lady at the meeting, you know, poor me, whatever, you know, all this, poor me. This kind of victimized thinking blocks off heart intelligence and creates perceptions that are narrow and confused. The way out is to activate appreciation and see a wider picture. It is not just a soft concept. It shifts our attitudes and our perceptions, and it draws fulfilling situations towards you. You know, when I'm locked in my poor me, narrow, confused story, I am not open to receive all the gifts that the world is offering every single moment. There's always something. Little Buddha, you know, he was crying at the poor little worms, but then he also had this spontaneous, oh, and, wow, this beautiful day out on the field in the world, you know. This is always available for us. And this is part of the heartbreaking part of being human is, you know, they're both happening all the time. Our hearts are being broken, you know. We're reading the news and we're thinking about, you know, these terrible things that people do to each other. And at the very same moment, there are just as many people who are doing amazingly beautiful things with one another. You know, there's people helping each other. There's people being brave. There's people creating things and, you know, being kind. There's just as much of that going on as there is the shootings and the beheadings and the racism and the awful things that we do, you know. So, yeah.
This is an interesting topic, what you tell us, so I appreciate that. I feel the same way with Zen. It's very dry, there's not aspect of emotion in it. So I spent quite some time with Shambhala teachings for quite a while. So came much of that I really appreciate. And the first teacher I met at Shambhala, his name was Acharya Alan Schwartz, and he told this amazing story about, probably some people know here, about how Chogyam Trungpa and Suzuki Roshi are very close friends at the end of their lives, and how when Suzukiyo, she died, Chogyam Trungpa was there, and all the students of Suzukiyoshi were all sitting with stillness and not much emotion on their face, and then Chogyam Trungpa came to the memorial service and he just started crying, and then all the Zen students got the permission and all started crying and he was telling the story. There is some cultural aspect to Shambhala, and I do feel when I go to Shambhala's teachings I get access to that, and I was grateful to spend some time with a retreat with Pema children and Sakyan Lipan, who's the son of Jogin Trungpa. It was an interesting time in my life, it was a heartbreak, and I was there and I was able to receive Pema children's life direct teaching on this.
Mm-hmm.
I actually wrote a blog on this, I just found it. I could imagine you guys would like
to. Please!
But, yeah. There was a lot of emphasis on feeling a human feeling is actually experiencing being human and interconnectedness, which is a lot of the theme of Buddhist practice. She talked about be with the rawness and vulnerability of the sadness. Rather than justifying it, feel what you feel, then this amazing thing happens. This view that this is how humans feel, there's nothing wrong. There is this feeling that I can feel what I can feel, nothing is wrong here. Being fully conscious and awake, because you're not protecting yourself anymore in the raw, vulnerable space. You find wisdom and the human connectedness in that space. When you're willing to be genuine, squirming from your seat, so uncomfortable, but you have this love fair for yourself, loving yourself, if you feel what you feel, everything is basic goodness, which is a common jargon in Shambhala teaching, basic goodness. One may ask, what if I feel something you feel is negative, which you are addressing? If you touch anything fully and completely, what do you feel without the storyline beneath it, then that is basic goodness. She talks about this in a way, negativity is okay, but negativity is the problem.
Yeah. Well, I think we all, I think part of what is the opportunity of practicing Buddhism in America in 2015 is that, we have such a richness of teachings to draw from. And I know we talk about this a lot. I mean, we struggle with it because on the one hand, if everything just turns into everything else, then there's no distinctions. And maybe there's some distinctions that are the difference between Shambhala and Zen and the Vipassana. You know, maybe there's some, and the Thich Nhat Hanh, you know, comes here Monday night. Maybe there's some, and the koan tradition, you know, that Neti spent a lot of time in, you know. I mean, there's a lot of different manifestations of Buddhism, and maybe there's some benefit to them having some separateness. But on the other hand, if that separateness turns into a reason to be judgmental and not to draw from something that's going to be helpful, personally, I'm like, what's the point of that? If the Buddha's teaching was suffering, to understand suffering and the liberation from suffering, then that which supports us to be aware of the nature of our suffering and that which supports us to liberate ourselves from our suffering is wholesome. And if it has a particular color of robe or non-robe, so what? You know? And so I don't know. I mean, this is an interesting thing. I'm very much kind of walking in the middle of this ocean. You know, I wear the Zen robe. There's a lot I love about Zen, but I also feel a need to, you know, I'm calling the Sunday group heartfelt Zen because I have this need. It's like, we're going to talk about our feelings on Sunday night, you know, and we do here too. It's not like it's forbidden. But we do have this more kind of austere, quiet, you know, aspect. Or so it seems. I don't know. You know? It's an open question. It's an open question. But I certainly have found I need, personally, I've needed to study as broadly as I can to support my own liberation from suffering and to try to support others on their path. But I think we're going to be talking about this for some time. But I appreciate in this temple, at least, I feel like even though we are a Zen temple, and we like that, but there's a lot of cross-pollination and openness that I really welcome and want to be part of. So thank you for bringing those words forward and your experience. Mm-hmm. We have time for, if there's anybody else. Yeah.
I just want to express such heartfelt appreciation for you bringing this topic and exploring it like you have. I think it's a really good.
Well, there's really good resources out there, and we can keep exploring. And again, if you want to join us on Sundays, this is what we're doing. I have a poem. Maybe I'll close with this poem. Was there someone else? Oh, yeah, let's, we'll.
In the research about coherence, does it mention anything about the factor of classical music that may bring you to that point?
It doesn't, but it sounds like.
I was just curious.
Yeah. They did say that when you're doing this practice, if music is something that supports you to your coherence, to use that. I mean, they basically say, you know, for their practice is just the more time you can spend with your heart in coherence, the less stress you'll have in your body, and the more the wisdom part of the brain will be strengthened. Mm-hmm. You know, so whatever helps. Mm-hmm. Yes?
Music. And you know that I used to teach high school, and I taught language, Spanish as a foreign language, and Spanish to Spanish speakers. And the research says it's easier to learn a language when music is being played, particularly, and when the music is 60 beats per minute.
Wow.
It's very particular, and Mozart reaches that. If there's something you want to learn, play Mozart. There's pretty serious research about that. I don't know how it relates to coherence.
Well, I think what I remember from that part of the book is they said, look, if music is something that, you know, gets you to green, do it, you know? So I'd like to read this in closing. This is something I wrote in 2001, and I wrote it inspired by sitting where Nettie is sitting, and Catherine was sitting here. Catherine was the root teacher for me and for many of us here. She was our head teacher and abbot for many years here at Santa Cruz. Her face is one of the ancestors that you see in the back of the altar when you come in. And I wrote this, now she had been here, let's see, 01, she came here in 89, so this was, what, 12? Yeah, so she was, I would say, it felt to me like her teaching here was really mature. I mean, she knew us, we knew her, we'd been through a lot, and, you know, she was kind of at the top of her game. So, sitting on the cushion next to you, while you speak before the assembly, I think of a persimmon, long ripening, whose sweet interior fruit is squeezing out, splitting open through the protective skin. You say, people come here in hopes of getting wise, but what I want you to show me is your compassion. So thank you for that, Catherine, and thank you all for your attention and participation. Beings are numberless.
I love to save them. Illusions are inexhaustible.